Welcome to Off Topic. I'm Kathy Jaffray.
And I'm Idris Goodwin, filling in for Stephen Hayward, who's on assignment in China right now.
And this week we're talking about race, racism, white privilege, and the persistence of these issues in American society.
Because race and racism and white privilege are not the easiest things for most Americans to talk about, we decided to devote an entire episode to such discourse. And given the controversial recent Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman decision, I think people want to have the race conversation. I mean, even the president, you know, is like, what's going on? And he's the president of the United States, you know what I mean? And he's like, what's going on with us?
At least you ask yourself your own questions about, am I wringing as much bias out of myself as I can? Am I judging people as much as I can based on not the color of their skin, but the content of their character?
So if we're going to talk about this issue of race, it seems like one of the first things we need to do is talk about, what is race? What is this thing that has such power in our lives?
Yeah, is it actually biological, or is it purely theoretical? Does it speak to a person's culture, their socioeconomic status? Can one transcend it? You know, what is race?
So we talked to philosophy professor Charles Mills of Northwestern University. He's the author of The Racial Contract. And we discussed with him the issue of, what is race? Where does it come from? Who gets to define it? How has it been defined in American society?
We've grown up in a society where racial categories have been naturalized. So it comes, quote-unquote, naturally to us, but it's a naturalness that is a product of socialization. So, you know, the question we need to ask ourselves is, where did these categories come from in the first place? My claim, and of course it's not just me, there are a lot of other people I'm agreeing with, is that even if you have race in a pre-modern form, the sort of most important developments in sort of consolidating racial theory has to do with European expansionism. So European expansionism from the modern period, you know, the voyages of Columbus, 1492, you know, what that leads to in terms of a world that's, you know, conquered, you know, by the European powers, and that race really comes into its own in that period.
So can you give me an example of that? Can you give me an example of being able to see in the historical record the construction of racial categories tied to this colonial expansion?
Well, what we need to look at is how Europeans are going on these voyages, voyages to the Americas, voyages to Africa, how they're sort of seeing the people that they encounter there. And, you know, what you find is this perception of difference, which gradually becomes crystallized into categories of race. So that, you know, you have race emerging as a term in many European languages over roughly the 14th to the 16th centuries. And then people are starting talking to use race specifically to divide the human population in the 1600s or so.
And not just to divide, but to rank different groups.
Yes, that's absolutely crucial. It's important to sort of make a differentiation. It's not necessarily the case that categorizing people racially sort of commits you to racial hierarchy, but it has usually been the case that they've gone together. So the history of race is intimately tied up with the history of racism.
And we certainly see in the United States an enormous effort put forth over and over and over again to try to justify those inequalities.
Yes, certainly.
On the basis of biology, on the basis of, you know, neuroscience.
Of course.
On the basis of, you know, on cultural arguments that okay, maybe there's no biological difference, but there's a cultural difference.
Yes, and that's become crucial importance since World War II. In fact, there are many theorists of racism who would say that old-fashioned biological racism was largely discredited by the Holocaust, and that in recent decades, the dominant variety of racism has been cultural. So the idea is not anymore that you're saying these other races are biological inferior, But you're saying, for example, in the case of blacks in the United States, that they're not willing to make an effort, that they're lazy, that they prefer to live on welfare rather than to go for a job. So you now have a shift that seems more respectable. So that if you define racism as biological racism, these people will be able to say to themselves, well, clearly I'm not being racist. I'm not saying that blacks are biological inferior. I'm just sort of, you know, facing the fact, which other people need to face too, that blacks are not as willing to make an effort. So the many theories of racism would say that cultural racism has now become the dominant kind.
Great. So one of your books, one of your many books, is called The Racial Contract.
That's right, yes.
Can you explain to me how this racial contract works?
Okay, so what I'm doing is I'm picking up on a central concept in political philosophy and political theory, central to modern liberalism and modern Western political philosophy, which is the idea of the social contract. So what social contract theory says is we're trying to work out how we should think of society, how we should think of the government, how we should think of the rights people should have. And the idea is an illuminating way to think of this is to imagine society as if it were the product of a social contract among people. But an important point for all purposes is that when they're talking about people having equal rights, they weren't for the most part talking about women. And for the most part, they weren't talking about people of color either. It's a contract among white men to see white men as equal, and then you position people of color, so Native Americans, African slaves, colonial populations, you position them as inferior, and they do not get equal rights.
Right. So isn't this, couldn't this just be an easy fix, though? Couldn't you say, okay, that was a long time ago. We do better now because we know better now. Couldn't we say that it's easy to fix the social contract just by making it more inclusive? Okay, now everyone has property rights. Okay, now everyone has voting rights. Isn't that a simple fix?
Absolutely. But we need to distinguish between a nominal fix and a substantive fix. So we can certainly say that these guys' ideas were important. It's unfortunate they were sexist and racist, but it's easy to correct for that. And it's not the case anymore across the globe that, you know, you have overtly racist states. But the question is, what is the legacy of these racial systems? And if the legacy of these racial systems is not addressed, it then means that even if people have equal rights on paper, then people of color are still going to be disadvantaged by the legacy of the overtly racist period of these states. You know, we're now in a situation where the legislation of Jim Crow was repealed. We had what was called the Second Reconstruction of the 1950s and 60s. But the question then we need to ask ourselves is, has racial equality been achieved in the United States? And unfortunately, if you look at the social indicators, the answer is obviously no.
Then how do we begin to address this, or better yet, redress this, when an enormous segment of the population isn't on board with that project?
Precisely. And of course, you've put your finger on the heart of the matter. In order to redress this, you're going to need majority white support. Whites are not merely the numerical majority, but obviously they have hugely differential social and political power disproportionate to their actual numbers. So a project of national racial reform can only get underway with majority white support. And the unfortunate thing is that majority white support is not there.
And why is that? Why do you think majority white support is not there for something that seems so in line with the founding ideals of the United States?
Well, part of the problem, of course, is that many whites now think that institutional racism, to the extent that it exists, is a thing of the past, that basically blacks are just sort of a crying victim, and that it's not the case that the obstacles that face them are external obstacles having to do with racism and its legacy. It's basically internal obstacles. As I say, that, you know, the opportunities are there for everybody, and blacks just don't want to make an effort. So racial ideology sort of undergoes a shift, and it's now sort of takes the form of, you know, a large percentage of whites basically thinking, yes, we agree that the social indicators for blacks are, you know, significantly different and worse, but that's not because of racism. It's a different kind of explanation.
That was philosophy professor Dr. Charles Mills of Northwestern University, author of The Racial Contract.
I think he makes a very compelling and I think urgent point. Because everyone's kind of like, we've been having these conversations over and over and over again. You know, there are these incidents that happen and we bring out our old boxing gloves and we go some rounds and then we get tired and just turn on Jay Leno or whatever. But I think the thing that he brings up feels very of the moment, which is this is not a black issue. This Trayvon Martin incident and all the incidents that will inevitably occur in the future can't just be, you know, the black community by themselves with white folks on the peripheral going, yeah, that's right, y'all, go ahead. You know what I mean? It has to be something we all own. And I think the way to do that, I'm not white, so I can't really say, but I think the way to do that is for white folks to really begin to unpack what is whiteness? What is this construct of whiteness?
Right, because for generations now, for centuries now, whiteness has been invisible. When we've talked about race, we meant being black, being Latino, being Asian. But white was invisible. White was normal. So we talked to Professor Heidi Lewis from the Feminist and Gender Studies Department at Colorado College about her class, Unpacking the Invisible Backpack, Critical Whiteness Studies.
The course is one that tries to make whiteness visible in conversations about race. We've, you know, for decades and decades, we've talked about African Americans, Asian Americans, Latinos. And so this course sort of asks that we start to think about how whiteness has been constructed and how whiteness functions and what it means to be white.
Tell me how whiteness has been invisible. What does that mean that whiteness has been invisible? I look at my skin, I look at skin around me, I see whiteness. How is it invisible?
The way it becomes invisible is more so in terms of ethnicity and culture. Racially, you can pretty much see who is and who is not white. But the thing that we start to ask ourselves is, how has whiteness become the norm? So white ways of thinking in the academy, the thought processes in the academy for a long time have been dominated by white men. And so we try to figure out what happens when you add voices of color, women, LGBTQ to that community. It starts to shatter this idea that white men are the norm, and white behaviors. So the ways in which we speak, how are those racialized? How are those related to culture?
Can you give me an example of that?
Sure. So, you know, if I'll give you a perfect example. The compliments, and I'm doing scare quotes for those of you who can't see me, that President Barack Obama is articulate.
Right.
There's an assumption there that as a black man, he would not be expected to be articulate, so that he is articulate in a very specific kind of way excites people. And it becomes a sort of way of saying, wow, you're one of us. You can speak like us. That's cool, because I wasn't really expecting for you to speak that way. So, you know, the assumption is that black is not smart. Black is not articulate in a very specific kind of way.
Right.
Black is criminal. Black is violent. Black is aggressive. And we haven't really decided and talked about what whiteness is or isn't. Because it's become invisible. It's become the norm. You know, you dress a certain way, you walk a certain way, you talk a certain way, you act a certain way. That's the norm. But what it really is a lot of times, not all the times, is it's white.
So give me an example of white culture, something that is white culture that would be invisible to me as a white person, that you would look at that and go, Kathy, you're so white.
Okay, so one of the tough things we talk about is sort of dominance and entitlement. You know, whenever there's conversations around affirmative action and there's backlash, there's a way in which white individuals feel as though people of color are taking over.
Right.
But the only thing that could be taken over is something that already belongs to you. So there's a sense of entitlement that is really, really prevalent that people of color feel and see all the time. Because whenever we sort of enter into spaces, we feel as though, okay, we have to work really hard. We have to make sure we say the right thing. We have to make sure we're very articulate and clear. And because we know that this space doesn't belong to us. And we know that we have to work hard to enter this space. This doesn't apply to all people of color, and it doesn't apply to all white people, but it does apply in huge ways that are identifiable.
And so there's a way that I'm thinking about the difference between a white person and a black person going into a department store. I'm white, so when I go into a department store, no one assumes that I'm shoplifting. I'm not followed by the store clerk. I'm, right. You know, right? And so shouldn't we want everyone to have that privilege? Shouldn't that be part of it?
Yes. I think that the I grew up in Northeast Ohio, a town that was primarily white and black. We didn't really have a lot of other ethnicities represented in my hometown. And now that I've gotten older, things are different. I've lived a lot of different places. But, you know, there's a way in which it may not be the department store. It may be the neighborhood you move into. If you're the only black person in your neighborhood, which I thankfully am not, because there's a way in which neighbors start to ask questions. My husband drives a certain kind of vehicle. So when they see a black man driving that vehicle, they start to make assumptions about what kind of black man he is. Mm-hmm. And so then they might not let their kids play with our kids because they feel like, well, their parents are this and that. Now, we do get a lot of leeway from people who make assumptions because we are married. We share the same last name. So the heterosexual privilege that we have helps mitigate some of that racism because it's, you know, for some of them, it's like, oh, you know, you're married? Oh, that's great. Your husband actually is around? Because, you know, there's an assumption that black men don't do parenting. And so we do get some of the things you're talking about in terms of being in spaces and people looking at you in certain ways. A lot of that's mitigated for us when we're together. And I find myself when I'm alone in those kinds of situations you're talking about, saying that I'm married so that people back off. And because I don't wear a ring, it's not visible. And so people see me with my children and they start saying, oh, you know, single black mom, oh boy. And I tell them I'm a professor too. I hate saying that, but I say it in situations where I feel like I'm getting the looks. I'm like, hey, I'm a professor at Colorado College, not one of those people. But that's a problem too, because I shouldn't have to do that. Right. And me doing that sort of reinforces the need for black people to always be respectable people, and we shouldn't have to be.
And as someone who's a single mom for a really long time, I didn't have this problem that the fact that we have to say, oh, I'm not one of those people.
Exactly. It's really, and you saw this with the Trayvon Martin case. It was so infuriating. And again, as I just said, I admit to participating in that as a form of resistance toward that kind of, you know, marginalization. But it's also something I problematized because when the Trayvon Martin murder happened, you saw a lot of people saying, oh, you know, this was a really great kid. He had a 3.7. He full ride to college. He never did a thing. He saved his father's life. He was going to go to school. He went to church.
Right.
He shouldn't have had to be any of those things. He could have been the worst kid in the world. Did he deserve to die that night? But we did that sort of casting him as a good Negro because that's sort of a way that we resist that subordination by saying, look, we're good people too.
It seems to me, Heidi, that one of the things that we're talking about here is how difficult it is to have these conversations. I think that race is one of the things that Americans of all races, of all ethnicities, but I especially think for a lot of white people, it's a really uncomfortable topic.
It is. We're moving past that point of not being able to talk. Because I think that's one of the most important things that we need to do is we need to be able to have healthy, productive conversations. And whiteness is something that we do not talk about. I mean, we talk about race and racism. We don't talk about it well, but we at least talk about it.
Right.
We don't talk about whiteness at all. It's sort of like,
what causes it? What's the source of that discomfort?
I think that we have this myth, at least in the United States. I'm not really an expert in any other areas of the world. But in the United States, there seems to be a way in which we avoid the painful. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're like an instant gratification society these days. You know, it wasn't always like this. You know, people were patient and methodical and slow. Now everything's got to be quick, fast, quick, fast. And pain disrupts that. And race and racism is painful, and we don't like to talk about those kinds of things. It hurts, and then there's this overwhelming guilt that some of my students start to feel that it's totally useless, because guilt never, you know, fed anybody hungry or helped anybody theoretically, but they feel that and I allow them to so that they can move forward. But people don't want to feel guilty, and people don't want to feel sad, and people don't want to feel pain. And so I think that that's why we avoid these conversations. And another thing is that the United States already thinks it's the best ever. So why talk about something that proves that we're not?
Right.
And race and racism is a slap in the face of that. We're the best. And right. So I think that that's one of the reasons why, too.
Right. And so then if we're talking about the United States, where white privilege is so predominant that it is invisible, then how do we – what – I guess the question I want to ask is, how do we then start to unpack this when people are saying, I don't want to give up my privilege?
Right.
And when people say, you know, I'm not a racist. I didn't cause this. I didn't shoot anybody.
Right.
Leave me alone.
Oh, that's two things. So the thing about I didn't start it, I think one of the ways that we sort of challenge that is to ask people to think about how they benefit. So you may not have started it, mm-hmm. but if you benefit from it and you're a participant, then you need to be held accountable, just as I do. And then the I'm not a racist thing, I was thinking about the George Zimmerman trial on one of our first days of class. We talked about this because I think one of the things people get really misconstrued is that white privilege is separate. I don't talk about white supremacy for a minute. They think that the prerequisite for white supremacy is white skin. Mm-hmm. And so the rhetoric around the case was, well, hey, look, you know, George Zimmerman is Latino. This could not have been about race because he is a man of color as well. And so Trayvon is a man of color, too. So this is not about race. White supremacy is a theory, a way of seeing and explaining the world. Anyone can have it. Anybody, whether they're a person of color or not. When you see a black man and you get scared, I don't care if you're another black man. That's white supremacy telling you to be scared of your own self. Mm-hmm. You know, so George Zimmerman could have been a dark Latino for all I care.
Right.
Just because, you know, he's a Latino man does not mean that he is exempt from the theory that tells him to be fearful of black male bodies. The same result would have happened whether or not Trayvon Martin had a hoodie on, to be honest.
Right.
But, you know, we see Mark Zuckerberg in a hoodie and we don't go, oh, God.
Well, I do, but.
I don't know, right? I always tell my students, if you really looked at the data, you might get a little nervous. But so I think that one of the things that we can do to make a difference is to really, I love the theory. People think theory is, oh, fluff, 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 and it's about what you do and what can we do. Well, last time I checked, thinking was a verb. And theory is a way to talk about ways we think. Mm-hmm. And we can have all the, I mean, we've had affirmative action for how many decades and people still think that black people are undeserving, people of color are undeserving. So until we change the mind, those policies are going to be ineffectual, in my opinion. I mean, they're good, but they're not all the way, they're not doing it all.
That was Professor Heidi Lewis from the Feminist and Gender Studies Department at Colorado College.
This is Off Topic. Stay with us.
Welcome back to Off Topic. I'm Kathy Jaffray.
I'm Idris Goodwin.
And when we were putting together this show, our producers actually looked through the Oral History Project at Colorado College, and we found a piece that was pretty powerful.
Yeah, we came upon a recording of Effie Stroud Frazier, who was one of the first black female graduates of Colorado College in 1931. And she was interviewed and recorded by Cheryl Coleman in 1980 about, you know, what it was like for her at Colorado College during that time. And it's a very shocking and chilling reminder of the heaviness of this legacy and that it exists everywhere in every community, whether it be, you know, liberal arts colleges, rural neighborhoods, blue collar towns. So check it out.
I also want to say this is a really raw and powerful piece, but there is some language that some listeners may find objectionable or be sensitive to.
What were your impressions of CC when you first came to the college?
Well, when I first came to CC, of course, I won't say that it was altogether CC's fault. Because by that time, the attitude of Colorado Springs toward its black citizens was completely, astonishingly negative. We weren't even allowed on certain streets in this town. You cannot believe that, but this is absolutely true. Going over to the west of Colorado Springs, there were certain neighborhoods where we dare not go because we were chased, we were stoned, dogs were set on us. I never shall forget going to see a football game at our stadium. I arrived a bit late. Usually I had to, because I always had to work after school. My school naturally was seated on one side and the opposing one on the other side of the stadium. There was a black player on the opposing team. Just as I entered, my school was all chanting, "Kill that nigger! Kill that nigger!" And those words ring in my ears to this day. Mm-hmm. To this day, I have not learned as yet to like football.
At the time you were taking classes at CC, did any professors practice any racist theories?
Oh, I shall never forget one teacher of educational psychology, I believe he was, required us to use his own book, the book which he had written in this field. Now, what I shall never forget is that one of the chapters dealt with the inability of black students to achieve at the same level as white students. He said that we could achieve up to the time of puberty. After that, however, our educational ability declined, and we actually just could not learn after we became adolescents.
Well, how did he explain your presence at college and competing?
One of the students in the class actually said to him, "Well, how about the Stroud family?" Because at that time, our family had scored as the highest, as having the highest IQs in this whole city, except for one family.
Mm-hmm. And did your professor at the time know of this?
This other student, I forgot who it was, asked him, "Well, what about the Stroud family?" And he said, "Well, that just happened. We happened to be just the exception to the rule. But generally speaking, this was not so." And the year I got my degree from Colorado College, this was the saddest, I don't know, maybe this is why I feel so bad about Colorado College, is that my father had sacrificed everything wanting to see my degree. That's what he lived for. But he went blind the day I got my degree. Mm-hmm. And then right after that, when he learned that I was not going to be given a job except in the kitchen and washing the basement floors on my hands and knees, the same as if I had never seen a school, after my poor father learned that, I saw him just cry like a baby. And perhaps this is why the negative aspects of Colorado College stand out in my mind more than the positive, because I just really cannot think of anything positive that happened to me at that mm-hmm. school.
That was 1931 Colorado College graduate Effie Stroud Frazier talking about her experiences of racism right here. We talked with Rosemary Harris Lytle, president of the NAACP State Conference for Colorado, Montana, and Wyoming, about the legacy of racism and the ways in which we can envision moving forward. I want to start by talking about Trayvon Martin. And what I've been thinking in the past few weeks is Emmett Till was murdered in 1955. It's 58 years ago. And it seems like we're still having the same issues. We're still having the same problems. We're still having the same conversations. How can we see progress here in such a situation?
Well, thank you for the opportunity to talk about these issues and to dialogue and to have even this radio community conversation, much needed, as our president has suggested. And you're so right. It occurred to me on July 13th as my husband and I were landing in Orlando, Florida for the NAACP National Convention, and we discovered that George Zimmerman was going to avoid responsibility for the murder of Trayvon Benjamin Martin, it occurred to me that 58 years ago in Money, Mississippi, Emmett Till, another teenager, went to the store to get some candy.
Right.
Went to the store to get some candy in Money, Mississippi in the 1950s. All these years later, Trayvon Benjamin Martin goes to the store in Sanford, Florida, where I used to work as a reporter for the Orlando Sentinel, to get some candy. Both ended up dead. There is something wrong with this country that we are reliving these incidents, and I think it is that we have not shared the tears, we have not done the healing, and we haven't had the courageous conversations that would move us, I hope, past this.
It seems that there are two things that strike me that are at the root of some of this problem. One is inequality. When there is this massive inequality, that leads to the second problem, which is this fear. Fear that people are going to lose what they have, fear that that other person, the other, is going to come get it from them, fear that we have to start attacking each other or we're not going to survive. So how do we begin to address those two things, the inequality and the fear that comes from it?
It's so embedded into our country, these kind of economic divisions. I even think about the end of slavery and Reconstruction, when poor black people and poor white people had a lot more in common than poor white people did with rich white people. But because there was a fear that all these poor people, poor black people, poor white people, would join forces and they would then perhaps be able to, as you're saying, take away something that wealthy people who most of the time, not all the time, we got to tell the real history, but most of the time were of European descent, fear that they would come together, united by their common economic challenges. So how did we stop that? We stopped that by saying the Negro at the time, and I have a certain fondness for the word, the Negro is inferior. We need to put in place Jim Crow laws. The Negro is being elected to Congress in Reconstruction. No, we can't allow that to happen. And we certainly can't allow people across this kind of economic sharing that they have, this economic commonality, we can't allow them to join forces because there are more of them than us. And so that I believe that that is really a lot of what happened that kept us from coming together as people after slavery ended. It couldn't be allowed to happen. And so divisions were put in place that were so serious and so real that we're still feeling them and living them out today. But we know that when we watch, say, children, unless we tell them to hate, they don't. They hug.
Right. But those economic divisions, they're still here. They're still here.
They're still here. And, you know, Du Bois talked about the talented tenth of African Americans and its obligation to sort of pull up, if you will, and they used this word, this kind of language at the time, pull up the rest of the mighty race. The obligations of the talented tenth, those who managed to be educated. Somehow, I believe that didn't happen. So we have, as African Americans, failed each other in some cases. In some cases, we've been failed by those who should be our brothers and sisters across cultural lines. And then in so many cases, we've been failed, as in the case of these Stand Your Ground laws and other laws, by policy that's been put in place in this country. And it is a huge thing. How do you chip away at it?
But, you know, you mentioned Du Bois, and I've been thinking about Du Bois. I've been thinking about, you know, his famous quote that the problem of the 20th century is going to be the color line.
That's the problem of the color line.
And here we are in the 21st century. And,
you know, the problem is still the color line. And I don't know how many times we can say it's still the color line because we've refused to see it, because we've refused to give voice to it as a nation, because we've refused in large part to change it. It's not going to go away until we do so as a nation. And how do we begin to have those conversations in a kind of whole cloth way when we, for so many years, generations and generations, resisted having them based on, you know, our own fears, based on our own greed in some cases, based on our own ignorance.
Right. Tell me, you said you have a fondness for the word Negro. Tell me about that.
Well, there is another essay that's called The New Negro. And in my mind, I think about people who were people who didn't have so many resources, but who had so many dreams and vision and grace and style and elegance. And the capital N, Negro, to me is a person of a time where communities cared about each other, could have an opportunity to build villages and had people like my grandmother, who everyone called Big Mama or addressed her as Miss, and would never, you know, would do everything, would do anything to see her smile because she was so respected. Communities that were strong and rich and vibrant and full of people who saw nothing but opportunity for their children. And they were new Negroes. They were from the South, and they shook that off. And they went to places like Gary, Indiana. And even though they worked in sooty steel mills like my father did, I always watched when he'd come home, he would change clothes downstairs so as not to go upstairs where my mother had all this covered furniture. You know, they worked so hard to get that plastic.
Right.
So, you know, I embrace a time of, you know, I'm not so hard on our young people. I don't like so much to tell them how it used to be. But I embrace that time of no sagging pants, of where right. I didn't have to say, baby, pull your pants up. Although I've never had anyone say no when I asked with, baby, come here, could you pull your pants up for me? Right. I don't want to see all that. And yes, ma'am, is usually, or yes, or certainly is the reply. But a time before we even had to deal with that, when people were so focused on this, you know, up you mighty race, that they would never have thought that what happened to Emmett Till would be happening to one of their great-grandchildren or great-great-grandchildren.
That was Rosemary Harris Lytle, president of the NAACP State Conference for Colorado, Montana, and Wyoming.
This is Off Topic. Stay with us. Welcome back to Off Topic. This is Idris Goodwin.
I'm Kathy Jaffray, and we're talking about race, racism, and white privilege.
You know, one of the themes that's been running through this conversation about Trayvon Martin is this question of was this a benevolent young man or not? You know, some people on the Zimmerman side of things have been like, you know, this kid was no saint. He smoked pot. You know, he wore the saggy pants. You know, there's this.
He had a hoodie.
He had a hoodie, he had a hoodie. And you know, there's a big part of this is about perception. And the way in which, you know, particularly young black males are presented to people who don't have young black males around them. There's this image that's in the culture that is a particular framework that the Trayvon Martins of the world exist within.
Right. And so if we're going to address these issues of culture and of images that are embedded in culture, we thought it would be a good thing to talk to Professor Claire Garcia. She's a professor in the English department and also the director of the Race and Ethnic Studies program at Colorado College. She's also currently working on a book project, an anthology called When White Writes Black, White Authored Narratives of Black Life from Uncle Tom's Cabin to Django Unchained.
The project was actually inspired by several heated conversations that were going on among several of us colleagues here at Colorado College, as well as colleagues of mine who work in race and ethnic studies, about the unprecedented popularity of both the book and the film, The Help. I think a lot of us, especially those of us who grew up at a certain period in the history of American race relations, were bemused by the appeal of this book to such a wide-ranging audience. People of all ages seemed to love both the book and the film. And we wondered why this narrative of a young white woman helping a group of black women to find their voices in civil rights era Mississippi struck such a chord right now. And then, of course, the more we talked and looked at it in the historical context, we saw, one, it's not unprecedented, as our subtitle says, starting with Uncle Tom's Cabin, and probably starting even earlier with the notion of white authentication of black texts. So, for example, slave narratives were often heavily edited or mediated through white editors or helpers or assistants. So I think the issue of narrative authority is very central to the problem and paradox of blackness in America.
Explain to me what narrative authority means, and I want to connect this with the book you're working on. What the things that you have found or your contributors have found in their research.
As an English professor, I always tell my students that the meanings in our lives are created and generated by stories. The stories we tell about ourselves, the stories we tell about the world that we live in. We make sense of our relationships through stories and through narratives. So narratives are very fundamental, I think, to human experience. So narratives are very powerful. And the issue of who controls narratives, who has the authority to speak, is central to our understanding of ourselves as Americans, how we situate ourselves in relation to our past, how we envision ourselves in our collective future. And so I think that for obvious reasons, it's been very important for white people to control the narratives of who we are as Americans. And certainly as if you look at the long and complex racial struggles in the United States. Who determines what that history is? Who determines the trajectory of that history is very fundamental.
As a professor of literature, and as someone who is looking at literature and the analysis and study of literature is something that can illuminate our lives, when we think about issues about understanding racism in the United States, we tend to turn to the social scientists, to the sociologists, the political scientists, the economists. How can analyzing this literature help us understand more fruitfully the complex issue of race in the United States?
I believe that stories have a power that numbers and data don't. I believe that stories have a great humanizing power. And given my take that the fundamental problem of racism is the problem of recognizing other people's humanity, I believe that while we obviously do need the data, we do need policies, we do need legislation to address racism and the problems of racism in the United States, I believe strongly that racism is primarily structural. And so we need structural solutions to these problems. But I also think that if we're ever going to be our best selves or even to have the relationships among Americans that are worthy of our heritage and of our collective dreams, that
we need to make Black humanity present to wider audiences, and that's why I go to literature.
There is a problem when Black humanity has to be filtered through or authenticated by whites.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that although it may have been for Harriet Beecher Stowe a really wonderful first step, that now, 150 years later, we should be past the point where Black humanity has to be authenticated by white voices.
Yes, and obviously the white narratives of Black humanity are self-serving. They serve white interest. And I think that one of the limitations is that, and again going back to the problem of recognizing Black humanity, is that they're these very limited identities that the white imagination imposes upon Black experience and Black humanity. Clearly, one of those paradigms or ideas is the Black male criminal. I mean, that's what we saw in the Trayvon Martin case. We see also the angry Black woman. And these paradigms are so, one, they're so constraining, but two, they're so powerful that they actually have the force to erase what someone might actually see. So, for example, that George Zimmerman could see a dangerous Black criminal up to no good in a barely 17-year-old young man with an iced tea and a box of Skittles bobbing his head to his iPod, or that certain people could see in Michelle Obama with her pressed hair and J. Crew cardigans an angry Black revolutionary who hated America. And so one aspect of this project that just mystifies me and drives me coming back to the book is how does this happen? You know, how are these fixed ideas of what Blackness is, how are they so powerful that they can actually erase the physical and historical and other kinds of evidence of reality?
That was Professor Claire Garcia from the English Department at Colorado College.
Coming to the end of our conversation today, and the big question that's, I think, on my mind and most people's mind is, so what do we do? You know, I mean, most people, I believe, are good folks. Most people, I believe, would rather there be no racism. You know what I mean?
People don't want this. For the most part, people do not want this.
For the most part.
For the most part.
So the question becomes is, what do we do? Like, how do we fix this? Like, all the, you know, if the president of the United States can't kick off, you know, a conversation, you know, what are we going to do as citizens, as mere mortals? And I, in the wake of this, my friend Roger Bernier Agard, who is an accomplished poet and educator, born in Trinidad, lived in New York for many years, but now lives in the great city of Chicago where he works, has a very interesting idea to combat issues of racial profiling, of segregation. He calls it Occupy Whiteness. And just a note to our listeners, there is some strong language in this segment.
I'm going to take you back to something that happened in 2003. So in 2003, I'm in South Africa. I'm performing in Cape Town. Me, Stacey Ann Chin, and Ursula Rucker. For many of the Black people in Cape Town, that's the first time they were coming to the university there. Before, there was no reason for them to come there, and, you know, apartheid finished yesterday, right? And so they were coming up to the building, and in some cases, like literally, like physically, like kind of shook to walk in the building. And so here, here are we, right? Like a Black Trinidadian, a Jamaican, and a Black American, like telling these South Africans, no, yeah, no, you could come in. Come into the dressing room. Come and sit here with us. Come and have a good time. Come and look around. You know, meanwhile this is happening in South Africa, my girlfriend back in Brooklyn, a white woman, is looking for an apartment for us. She's walking by places and going into things, and they're practically begging her to drop a check right then. They're like, this is really finished. This is so good. Da, 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 da. We'll also do this. We'll do this. We'll do this. Like, she came back with all these numbers, all these places. By the time I get back from South Africa, she's really excited. She tells them, when my boyfriend comes home, I'm going to bring him by, and then I'll see if he likes it. As soon as I show up, interest in having her rent the place like goes real south real quick from everybody. Well, the place isn't really ready yet, and I don't know if I'm going to rent it anymore. Like, dude, place after place after place, right? So here we are trying to help black people feel at home in South Africa, and, you know, there's a space exclusivity thing working against me back here in Brooklyn, the most chill of the spots we thought in America, right? For people of color to be able to live in. Trayvon Martin happens. And the sense of despair I felt immediately, the sense of like I'd been lying to all the kids I've been teaching for all the years, right? Like telling them they could be somebody, telling them, I know it's fucked up, but if you do this, 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 and this, you can't be denied. You know, I have this brand new baby girl feeling like I've already been lying to her, telling her she could be anything she wants in the world, because it's really obvious, like America is making it really clear to us that that is indeed not so. And so the very next day I wondered, like, how do we get past this? How do I, you know, I was really thinking about Nina. I was like, how do we get to 20 years from now that she doesn't have to deal with it? Or what am I going to tell her I did when she's 16 and the next Trayvon Martin happens? You know, and so I'm thinking, so I got to thinking about like, what's the cultural shift that needs to take place? Because it's not a legal shift. Like, it's illegal to shoot a motherfucker dead. We know that, right? So it's not like, there's not a law that has to be passed. Something has to happen culturally for that to be a thing that can't happen here anymore. And part of that cultural shift to me has to be that the presence of us in spaces that we are uncomfortable with, or that we deem white people's spaces, or that white people think are their spaces, has to become not a thing anymore. You know, I have a fantasy that, you know, George Zimmerman leaves his house that day to go patrol, and there's 10 niggas walking the streets. And so he says, oh, I guess niggas live here now, and he goes home. That's my fantasy. So I'm thinking, how do you create a cultural shift, right? How do you teach people they belong in a place? And how do you teach other people that those people belong there? And so I thought, you know, I think I just need to get black and brown youth together and send them to places. Tell them, go to those places. Beaches, libraries, the public spaces of corporate buildings, the opera, the farmer's market on the other side of town. And hope it catches fire in a number of different places, such that we start feeling that we start with this generation, with this current, you know, generation digital or whatever it is they're calling them now, of people of color, start making them believe they belong in these spaces, so that generation digital of white people start understanding that whether or not they're allies or they're not racist or whatever, that they just start recognizing that, oh, well, niggas live here now, and, you know, we're accustomed to it, and so live and let live. I want to have 5 youths of color, you know, just be up in the Steppenwolf, and not because somebody, some benefactor, like, is like, you know, oh, bring colored kids to the theater day, but because they were like, because they decided, hey, yo, there's this dope play at the Steppenwolf, let's go. And so 4 20-year-old black kids decided to go up to the Steppenwolf, and they sat around in the lobby outside the Steppenwolf and talked about the play, and they went up in the play, and they sat down, and they looked at the play, and they laughed the way black people laugh when, you know, things happen in plays, and they come out, and they talk mad shit about what happened in the play the way black kids do. And my hope is that, again, when Nina is old enough to do it, that it ain't a thing, that it's not, that Occupy whiteness no longer exists because it's no longer necessary.
That was Roger Bonaire Agard talking about Occupy whiteness. His latest book is a masterpiece called Bury My Clothes, which touches on a lot of these issues that we've been talking about today. You know, one could devote an entire radio station to this kind of conversation.
Well, I think that's one of the things that we've heard over and over again from everyone we talk to, is that the conversation has to happen. And we think that, oh, haven't we had this conversation before? Maybe, but we still need to keep having that conversation, keep having these discussions. If you care about this country, you got to be part of this conversation.
So I hope folks listening continue the conversation after Kathy and I shut our mics off.
Off Topic is produced by Craig Richardson and Jake Brownell with help from the Tim Gill Center for Public Media, a part of Rocky Mountain PBS, in association with Colorado College and KRCC in Colorado Springs.
If you'd like to go back and listen to any part of this episode, or if you're interested in listening to previous episodes of this program, please visit us at offtopicradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter or find us on Facebook.
I'm Kathy Jaffray.
I'm Idris Goodwin.
Until next week,
stay off topic.